American Social History Podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project, Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York. This presentation took place at the CUNY Graduate Center as part of our Bridging Historias through Latino History and Culture program, a National Endowment for the Humanities Bridging Cultures at Community Colleges project.
Thank you very much, Lisandro. Thank you, Maria. And thank you, everyone, for being here and willing to do what we believe in and what we enjoy. I hear all kinds of wonderful things about the work you've been doing, and I'm very happy to be part of it. So I am reminded of the fact that when Hostos was born, there was a rainstorm. And when he died, there was another rainstorm. He was born 19th century, 1839. He died in 1903 in the Dominican Republic, born in Puerto Rico, Mayagüez. So sometimes the weather has a way of prompting us to do important things in life. I have been working on research, as Lisandro mentioned, 19th century Latinos in New York and Latin Americans in New York City, or New Latins, as some of them call themselves, right? I have a tremendous amount of material that I would like to share with you, but I'm not sure that this will be the occasion to share a lot of that, because actually, rather than do a schematic presentation, I'd like to go in depth and do some things that really have to do with some contemporary issues, and to be able to connect on the one hand. So I'm changing the topic slightly to focus mostly on Hostos and Martí, and specific texts by them. The other thing that comes to mind is the passing of Mandiva yesterday, Nelson Mandela, one of, 20th century's most important figures in the world, finally said goodbye for a while. And he his contributions to South Africa were such, as well as to the world, and his inspiration, that I'd like to dedicate this morning's session to his memory and do something that is actually very much in the same vein as he worked for in terms of racial understanding, non-racialism. So the texts that I chose today to work with are texts that have to do with race, and they have to do with women to some extent too, although these were not written in New York City. But I do have that perspective in mind. The two main figures that I'd like to discuss today are Eugenio María de Hostos, mostly known as an educator, Puerto Rican born 1839 in Mayagüez, of a mixed Dominican Puerto Rican heritage, actually Caribbean. His grandfather was from Cuba. His mother was Dominican, his father was Puerto Rican, and he's certainly one of the 19th century intellectuals and activists who will promote a what they call an Antillean Confederation, along with Betances and Luperón, general from the Dominican Republic, and along with José Martí. So Hostos is better known as an educator, but he's not widely recognized. He's also well known as a sociologist, one of the first Latin American sociologists, but he's not widely recognized for a number of other contributions that I think are really significant to the point that they have been neglected. And we need to really bring that back. The problem with Hostos' work is that it has been translated very sparsely. And the only anthology that exists was published in the early 90s by the University of Puerto Rico and CUNY and the city of San Juan, and it was not done through commercial means. So it's out of print, and there's no future reprinting in sight. So we are working with diverse materials. I am actually translating Hostos into English, and that's one of the reasons why I'd like to share these translations with you, so that we can look at his work and examine it, promote it, analyze it, critique it. He's an extraordinary 19th century humanist, and his contributions not just to politics and literature, but also to a number of other significant areas is to be held us a, we're on a world, you know, contemporary level. So I'm sorry that I don't have this picture. And Martí was born in 1853. His father was Valenciano from Valencia. His mother was from the islands, from the Canary Islands. So these are also marginal centers. They're not, you know, the center of culture and power in Spain. And so you may have known a number of things about Martí. Martí really did most of his significant political career in New York City. And of course, with travels throughout the southern part of Florida, Key West and Tampa and Ocala. But specifically spent almost 14 years in New York City and worked with intellectuals from New York City as well as from other points. So Martí is very much connection with intellectuals in the city, writers, people who do editors, journalists, a number of artists. And he is perhaps, because he had the option of informing himself through the media, because he was in New York City, he knew people who were influential, he wrote about them. He's probably the first modern journalist in Latin America. He actually was able to hear things that at the center when they were happening. So when Walt Whitman gives his last reading in 1888 in New York City, Martí is there and he writes an article. And when other people visit New York City, he manages to contact, visit, hear, and send to Latin America, La Nación in Buenos Aires, or to Venezuela, or to Honduras, or Mexico, El Partido Liberal, these wonderful texts that describe what was happening in the city. As we know from some of the translations that have been done about the Brooklyn Bridge, about the Statue of Liberty, about immigrants, about a number of important, he wrote over 200 escenas norteamericanas, right? So his production on New York scenes from 19th century was extremely, it was voluminous and extremely significant. Now, what I'd like to do is bring to you then some texts that we can discuss. And then from there, I can talk about specifics within the subject and in the lives of also San Martín and what they were presenting to the Latinos or Latin Americans at the time. Right? Hostos, Eugenio María de Hostos, came to New York in October 30th of 1869. That was a very busy time in New York City and in the United States as a whole. The whole time of Reconstruction, the extraordinary development that was taking place in New York City. The Brooklyn Bridge started to be built on that year. The public library had been founded the year before. A number of institutions were actually founded or taking off. Even a subway was being experimented with in 1870. So this was real modernity. The modernity that people still talk about, although with less enthusiasm perhaps these days, that's maybe more from a historical perspective, was very much happening in a very intense and ideological way. People talk about progress. People spoke about the need to bring reform. The schools were certainly an area where both Latin American intellectuals and United States intellectuals started to devote time and attention, so that because it was a crucial issue with regards to what should be the foundation of our nations. And therefore, both Martí and particularly Hostos, they're extremely interested and devote a good amount of time and effort to thinking education, thinking about education. The Hostos story will take him to bring him to New York very briefly. He went to study in Spain, sent by his family, and became very involved in the struggle against the monarchy. He was a Republican, was very much influenced, like Martí would be later on, by a philosophical philosophical tradition that had made an impact in Spain, the Krausismo. Wilhelm Friedrich Krauss was a German philosopher who was not very much remembered these days, but was very well received in Spain. He had a very positive philosophy, one which proposed education and became very open to women. There was a search or a desire to reach some kind of harmony in life. And through education, this would be a way of empowering people as well as making them relate to life in a very self-fulfilling way. So Krauss is very much in the background for both Hostos and later on Martí when he goes to Spain. Not because they necessarily studied the philosopher, although they did, but because there are several institutions in Spain, including the Universidad Central, which had important professors as well as administrators, the rector, right, the president, who was Krausista. So they start conferences every Sunday to discuss education and to discuss the role of women. And so against that backdrop, and against the backdrop of Freemasons, which is another big institution in the 19th century and earlier, since the French Revolution, having a very decided impact on politics. They both were Masons, Martí and Hostos. Martí was not confirmed until a few years ago, but he's now known to have been a Mason. And there were a number of places where they participated with the Masons. The Masons were generally very interested in change, opposed to monarchy, opposed to any kind of control, with the intent of developing spiritually. So you had different stages of development, but human being as centrally and fundamentally able to go through a period and of stages of perfectionism, right? Women were not allowed, but that wasn't just with Freemasonry, right? That was with a good number of other institutions. In any case, I think women are now allowed, by the way, to be Masons. This is relatively new for the last couple of years. Hostos comes to New York disenchanted with the September Revolution, 1868 in Spain. He became a liberal, a radical within the liberal party, anti-monarchical, and he was able to propose to some of the leadership that the Spanish should really be treating the Antillas, right? Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic also, but was not under Spain's rule at that time, but Cuba, for sure, with a more autonomous set of rules that would allow Cuba and Puerto Rico to set their own fiscal priorities and be able to develop in ways that the Spanish monarchy and Catholicism had not allowed because of central control. Also, when the revolution in Spain comes to power in 1868, September 1868, he's hoping that there will be changes and that there will be a different policy towards the colonies. That doesn't quite happen. It's a time when the Cubans are embarked in a war for independence, Céspedes, and Francisco Vicente Aguilera, and the Oriente uprising in October the 10th, 1868, and a similar kind of uprising that was not as successful and did not last very much, but in Puerto Rico on September 23rd in Lares. But the reasons were quite similar. These were revolts against centralism and against excessive taxes and against secondhand citizenship, if you will, lack of recognition of power, including in term political terms. And so Hostos flees Spain at age 30 to come to New York City, where he was incorrectly informed that there would be an expedition leaving for Puerto Rico. to take up arms against Spain. There was no expedition leaving, and he actually stayed during that first sojourn about 1 year. And from New York, he's going to be looking at both the United States and Latin America, but in a very curious dynamics with a Cuban patriotic junta, which was largely controlled by pro-annexationists, or Cubans that were favoring annexation to the United States. And he's very much against all that. It's a nationalist. He becomes very much in favor of Puerto Rico being independent, of Cuba being independent, and the three or four Caribbean nations coming together in a confederation. So what I'd like to do then, I'd like to share with you then the text that has to do with the Hostos's exposure to Native Americans in the United States, and then what he did with it later on when he traveled to Chile. He kept a very interesting diary, a journal. A lot of people did, writers kept journals during the 19th century. He thought, in this case, he was trying to use it as a way of examining himself, as a way of revising his way of thinking, of looking at himself introspectively. So he says, he's very honest in his diary. He says things that I don't think that he would have wanted people to hear necessarily, but he was very honest. He was very straightforward. He was almost politically incorrect about a lot of things that he said. And therefore, we see Hostos as not necessarily as official. And it's very important to get that kind of intimate thinker. He arrived in the United States in 1869, the same year that the first transcontinental railroad was completed between Omaha and Sacramento. This was a milestone in a campaign to promote the settlement and development of the West. It also transformed strategic, geopolitical, and economic thinking, having to do with the Mississippi. And that is going to be reflected in terms of military strategy as well as economic development in the United States. But the West was won at a very high cost in terms of displacement and genocide of Native Americans, period. Hostos, a keen observer, expresses an interest in becoming better informed about the issues that affect Native Americans, I should say. So this is an entry from his journal for June 13th, 1870. He came here October 30th, 1869. It reads like this. Today, the Indian delegation that came to present their grievances to the white men, to the Great Father, is returning to its beloved forests, to remote havens where the survivors of the ancient natural settlers of this land have been relegated. Red Cloud, chief of the Sioux, has been outstanding for his eloquence, for his fervor in generous feelings, for his firmness, and for his forceful candor. I was born naked and I shall die naked, but that which the Spirit has given us, we will have. I want peace with the Great Father and with the white men, but if the Romans that they sent to Fort Fetterman continue to violate our treaties, stealing from us and killing us because we hunt, they're the ones who will want war, not us. That is a quote from Red Cloud. Let the Great Father destroy that fort and send us men that are not big drinkers or soldiers. This is what the noble patriot, and now comes back Hostos to comment on that. This is what the noble patriot, and he's talking about a noble patriot from the forest, using the term patriot in a very peculiar way, right? Interesting way. This is what the noble patriot of the forest has said in his two meetings with the president and in his three or four meetings with the Secretary of Indian Affairs, Cox. How much stronger, how more humane, healthier, and more productive would be the power of this country if instead of rejecting that noble race, it would attract it by means of miscegenation and by means of civilization. So we have here an interesting component. He's not just talking about civilizing the Indians, but he's saying, let's make children together. And there is a bit of a difference with regards to, in other words, it's not just teaching the barbarians, it's becoming one with them. And that's an interesting point. But no one is bringing this issue to that level of consideration, says Hostos. The Creeks and other neighboring tribes have congregated in the surroundings of Canada to send a message to the president and to Congress expressing the grievances of the Indian peoples and the means to establish more humane relations. May justice make possible the consequences of freedom. So that's Austos, 1870, New York City, declaring his interest about Native Americans. And he will leave New York utterly disenchanted with the whole political process with the Cuban junta and the different factions that were actually impeding a strong support for the Cuban revolutionary or independence wars on the front. And the people who were fighting later on, the military, will complain that the civilians were actually one of the reasons why we lost this war. I'm talking about the 10-year war, 1868 to 1878. And that's the other big confrontation that happens here in New York in 1884 in the hotel where two of the important military men from Cuba, the liberation movement, Maceo and Maximo Gomez, came to meet with Martí to try to pick up, to develop again an independence, a second or third war after the Little War in 1884. And that happened on 21 West 9th Street. And so Martí is then very much involved with the whole discussion of whether the government should be civilian or it should be military. Austos had a complete distaste for the annexation movement and denounced it. He was in a minority at that time. Of course, he worked for the newspaper of the junta, which is called the Revolution of Cuba and Puerto Rico. He was an editor, and he actually wrote articles that went against the editorial opinion, and he denounced annexation politics. I'm sure that you have read Lisandro's article on sugar and revolution, the whole dynamics of the slave production that came to New York. I did not really understand why there were so many annexationists on the Cuban junta until I read that over 50% of the sugar in the world was actually refined in Brooklyn. And that sugar, most of it was coming from Cuba and was produced by slaves. And some of the people who actually came to New York seeking to displace the Spaniards from the political power were owners of sugar plantations. And they were right here, trying to argue, discuss, negotiate with the government, Grant's administration, a recognition. But as there are issues here that we don't really understand, and that has to do with whether, why did Cespedes appoint the people from the Havana Club who were annexationists, right? And who had, maybe he thought that they would be able to connect better with the American political leadership. At any rate, Aldama and Morales Lemus and a number of other leaders, some of which were brilliant intellectuals, Ponce de León, for example, right, did support annexation, and Austos didn't. So he left. He left also because he became in love with a woman who went back to Colombia, a Cuban, the daughter of an emigre family. The point of it all is that he decides that he's going to go through Latin America to try to promote support for the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban Independence War, and also for Puerto Ricans' need for independence. And he spends a year in Peru, he spends about a year and a half in Chile, spends about another year in Argentina, goes through Brazil, writes about all this in extraordinary terms in a book called Mi Viaje al Sur. It's not translated, it's my journey to the South, to South America. And while he's actually leaving from Chile to Argentina, Austos was very poor. He didn't have much money. His family did have some money, but he was all on his own. And he had to earn every single cent, and he was not very good at making money either. So he got the support of the Masons and the liberals, and he made a living by writing articles for newspapers. So when he decides to move from Chile to Argentina, He's going to go and on a ship that goes down the southern part of Chile, the straits, the channels, and there are issues with the Native Americans, the Patagones. And this is the other text that I want to bring to your consideration, and it's called The Fear of the Patagonians. Patagonian Indians are both the southernmost part of South America that is being divided between Chile and Argentina. And the Patagonians were feeling the encroachment of the so-called civilization. So I want to please look at that, and I'll make some remarks, and then I will be able to perhaps bring in Martí for a couple of points. In this text, you're gonna see that Hostos is actually talking. It's almost a romantic setup that you could almost make out of it an attempt to write a story that wasn't really where no action takes place. Wasn't really a complete narrative because it becomes an essay. So it starts almost with a romantic setup. You know, it's becoming dark, and the whole situation is very threatening, very menacing, because the Patagonians have been attacking British ships, and the passengers who were English and Chilean and from other countries know this. But the previous attack, they actually went for a ship that had guns and was able to defend itself. The ship that they're traveling in doesn't have any guns, therefore it's relatively unprotected. And people are very upset and very afraid, therefore the fear of the Patagonians, right? But Hostos confesses that he's actually having a great degree of satisfaction because he is seeing how Europeans or white descendants of Europeans are afraid when they're unprotected for exactly what its civilization has done to Native Americans. Moreover, he then discusses the whole situation of what the West has done, either through expeditions of conquest or through scientific expeditions anywhere where there have been Native peoples. And he's very, very dramatic. He says they have left a trail of blood. And moreover, he will talk about the Patagonians' ability to defend themselves and how they are very smart because they actually are able to use intellectually the means that they have at hand, which means attacking ships by surprise, since they don't have the means to do it in any other way. So rather than criticize the Patagonians or the Native Americans for treachery, he's actually giving them credit. This is an inversion written in 1872. And it's not common when you see intellectuals discuss relationships that had to do with what they considered savages, whether noble or not, in terms that are not other than superior. You notice that in this discussion of Red Cloud, he talked about his eloquence. I still find anybody who has described Indian or Native American speech or presentations as eloquent. So this is again an interesting ability to go beyond the stereotype and the way that natives were characterized at the time. I want to leave Hostos there and then devote a few minutes to Martí because I think I'm running short of time. I included there for your perusal a number of excerpts about his speeches and his writings on women, because he will go on to Chile at a time when the liberals are in power and will meet some very powerful intellectuals, Lastarria, as well as late 19th century Chilean scholars. He will and politicians, including Amunátegui, who was then the Minister of Education, and at a time when Chileans were debating whether they would admit women to their universities. And he is actually proposing in two lectures the scientific education of women. That was happening in England to some extent. That was happening in this country to some extent. It wasn't really happening yet in Latin America. And it was a very intense and very important debate, national debate for the Chileans, right? The thing is that Hostos is, as well as Martí, focusing on science as a very significant lever for development. And he will actually believe that, you know, there's a morality that comes out of nature. And therefore, you know, morality has to be redefined in terms of natural natural world rather than mores that have to do with conventions or social practices or so on. Inherited social practices, that is. So Martí, as you well know, is trying to put together a revolutionary movement that will get rid of the Spanish colonialism in Cuba, but there is a quite significant and very elaborate set of relationships with a number of intellectuals and activists from the Caribbean. So it wasn't just the Cubans who were fighting for independence. There were also Puerto Ricans and at one point the Haitians and Dominicans who were threatened with annexation by the Grant administration. The Dominicans, of course, fought it under against Buenaventura Báez. Hostos wrote articles. I actually was able to retrieve a couple of his articles at that time, where he's very much surprised, baffled, and denouncing of the American Grant administration because it's doing in the Dominican Republic and Haiti what one of the worst things it could possibly do, which is support dictators for its own interests. This is, I'm sure I'll have a chance to perhaps share that with you at some other point, but it was a clear case of expansionism. It was a clear case where you had a dictator who was terrorizing his own people and who seemed to be interested in staying in power by getting support, military and other kinds of, especially money, from the United States. Now, there are some reasons why that happened. This took about 2 years in Congress, and there was a big hero involved here besides Luperón and Cabral, who led the resistance in the Dominican Republic. In this country, a guy named Charles Sumner from Boston, senator, important, radical Republican, friend of Lincoln, opposed to anything that had to do with slavery. And so he was then the director of the Foreign Relations Committee. And what the United States Navy got involved supporting Buenaventura Báez, and this was brought up in the Senate hearings. You are violating the Constitution. It almost reminds us of what we saw 100 years later in Vietnam. You're violating the Constitution, says Charles Sumner. This is the Powers Act. But there are other reasons why we may not want to be, you know, involved with the Dominican Republic, and that is they have a black republic that's starting to come to life. Why should we repress or annex or, you know, take away their independence? It was a significant issue at the time, and Hostos played a role, but many other people did as well in opposing it. Martí, on the other hand, tries to organize this movement from New York and from Key West and from all the other colonies of Cubans in the United States and Mexico and Jamaica, Venezuela, and he traveled to that end. He was able to bring people together. Not only was he able to represent the interests of those who actually thought that they would do better commercially if Cuba became an independent country, but he got a tremendous amount of support from tobacco workers, and that was something that didn't happen necessarily as a way of, in mechanical terms. He actually worked with tobacco workers to earn their trust. He did the same thing with blacks and colored people. So he, along with Rafael Serra, founded La Liga de Instrucción in 1889, which is a night school for blacks, for black, Cuban, and Puerto Rican blacks. And there were a number of teachers that after, you know, in the after hours, in the night time, they would actually teach uneducated blacks. They met on 3rd Street, close to, I guess, where is now Bleecker Street. And Serra will play a role supporting Martí. And when Martí dies, he was a journalist. He actually starts a newspaper called La Doctrina de Martí, Martí's Doctrine. Martí's essay on race is fundamental, because even though I think we can have several readings of that, and you have the text in front of you, that text actually reflects the need for unity in Cuba, right? But it's also coming from a humanist perspective that has gone beyond race as a category to describe human beings. It's proposing, it's actually denouncing race as a way of dividing humans. And this is interesting, because I think both also San Martí reach similar positions by different routes, but Martí is, number one, trying to avoid what obviously could already be seen, that is a racial war. And in the essay, he says twice, there won't be a racial war in Cuba because Cubans will be able to go beyond race. Unfortunately, he wasn't right. There was a racial war in Cuba in 1912, and that was a tremendous step backward for race relations in Cuba. But in his essay, Martí is trying to do two things. This appeared in Patria, which was the newspaper he published in New York City. This newspaper came out weekly or so. And the editor, the printer, I should say, was a Puerto Rican mulatto from Ponce. His name was Sotero Figueroa. And you can see that there are people from different countries, different islands, different races, including North Americans, supporting Martí. The idea is to create that kind of a coalition. The idea is also to go beyond race. He was a genius, because he was able to bring together the different factions, the military, the well-to-do, the workers, blacks, and while people attribute his success to oratory and intellect, I would like to think that he was just one of the sharpest political minds around. He was able to really put together a coalition of sectors that trusted him. And that's why he was able to organize a war against all odds at a time when both the U.S. government was not really too interested in having an independence movement in Cuba, and when the Spanish were still not terribly powerful, but powerful enough to maintain, you know, a hold there. So this is an interesting story. This is race in the 19th century that deals with Latinos, Latin Americans, and how to put together strategies that could work. I think I'm gonna leave it there. Thank you for your attention.
I think the process that Orlando's describing here, which is important, I think, in looking at the 19th century, is that all this activity by Martí, by Hostos, and those that even came before them, in many ways, was the fact that New York is really the principal stage, I would say, for a great deal of nation building. It would be a mistake to believe that all these activities were simply an effort to overthrow the Spanish. I think Martí realized that. This wasn't about overthrowing the Spanish. That was an important step, but this was about building nation. And so that's why the essays that Orlando is using go well beyond simply the activities of emigres who are seeking to overthrow a government in their native land. It has to do with questions about race, right? About diversity, about how a future Puerto Rico, a future Cuba,
right,
would be essentially organized as a nation. And that was taking place, imagine, in New York, which in many ways is a place that at this time is in the cutting edge of modernity, right? And where all these issues about what is the proper role of the state, for example, in regulating inequalities, right? In regulating racial difference, all of those things are being discussed, right? In which you have the tremendous differences between rich and poor, right? And the manner in which Martí, for example, and Hostos both looked at the problems of the U.S., thinking about how essentially a future Latin America, a future particularly Hispanic Caribbean would look like.
I think we can attribute that, of course, to number one, invention of the printing press, right? But beyond, you know, I'd like to just make a quick homage to the Cubans and Puerto Ricans to a lesser extent. You have to remember that Puerto Rico was always a poor island, contrary to its name. Or it was really a military spot where they actually were able to dock the big naval the armada that was bringing all the gold from South America and from Mexico stopped last at in San Juan, so it did not have a chance to develop as much as Cuba did or other islands in the Caribbean. So this is going to be reflected later on in the kinds of things that happen with the printing press. We received the printing press rather late, beginning of the 19th century. Cuba was already involved with all kinds of things before that. New York City and Philadelphia and New Orleans and Key West must have produced, I think I counted it once, it was 50-something newspapers in about a 40-year period. Granted, newspapers were then a bit more than sheets of paper with information. But this was the kind of activity that was happening among Cuban and Puerto Rican emigres, right? Immigrants, political exiles. A lot of it political, a fair amount of it too literary and informative. And towards the 1870s, there were a couple of very interesting magazines that had illustrations, rather sophisticated illustrations. New York City became the center also to send publications to Latin America. This is the story of Apple House. Apple House had an extraordinary story with regards to development of the press, of the book industry in this country. Daniel Apple from Boston came to live in New York and developed this extraordinary publishing house. And then, of course, both also San Martí, as well as many of the exiles, worked with Apple as translators or as editors. And they Apple started to get into the business of publishing cartillas, textbooks that would be used in the sciences and that would be used in the history, a number of, and these exiles, many of which were very accomplished intellectuals and translators, were involved in that work. So intellectual activity in New York City and in the Cuban exile communities was extraordinary. They published these newspapers that got smuggled. They had support from often, you know, the British or the Americans, and they were able to get, you know, newspapers in the ships and distribute them throughout. Sometimes some politicians in some of these countries like Luperón or would be supportive and play a role in helping to disseminate. Sometimes you would have countries in, like Chile or Argentina that had a very dynamic intellectual, or Mexico, right? A very dynamic intellectual development already, and would be eager to print or to disseminate publications that came from this country. So I think, even though I have not studied it, I am very much aware that there's a tremendous amount of power that goes on there with regards to dissemination of information.